So just a little introduction. I'm a psychologist by training, and I also have a background in public health. And I've been in Washington, D.C. for the last 12 years working on federal policy. I'm a trauma-trained scientist practitioner, so these are the issues that are near and dear to my heart. But most importantly, I'm a native Angeleno, and I'm very glad to be here in my hometown. And I was raised by a mom who worked at LAUSD for nearly 40 years. LAUSD, come on. she was a teacher and a school administrator. So these are the issues that we talked about in my house growing up, and this is where my heart lies. So glad to be here with you all. So what I'd like to do over the next hour is talk a little bit about three things. First, we're going to talk a little bit about the National Child Traumatic Stress Network and some of the relevant federal policies around the network these days. Also, you know, there's a lot happening in Washington, and I want to talk a bit about recent and emerging federal policy issues that relate to child trauma, to children and families, and how they impact the programs that we care about. And then finally, I want to talk about us, how we all, as trauma experts, as mental health experts, can really have an impact, even beyond our own schools and communities, but getting the word out to policymakers so that we can ensure that policies are trauma-informed. So first, let's start with the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. And I know that in introductions, several of you mentioned that you're either current grantees or affiliates. Can we just have a show of hands of who's affiliated with the network? All right, great, fantastic. And for those that aren't directly affiliated or members currently, how many others know about the National Child Traumatic Stress Network? Have used some of our materials and resources? Great. So we're among friends, but I'll just give a little bit of background about who we are and what we do. The National Child Traumatic Stress Network was actually established by Congress in 2000 as part of the Children's Health Act. And our mission is really about raising the standard of care and increasing access to services for children and families and communities that are impacted by traumatic stress. Now, we're funded through SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is the primary federal agency focused on mental health services. And we are coordinated by the UCLA Duke University National Center for Child Traumatic Stress. And that's where I work. I'm on the Duke University side, but based in Washington, D.C., for a policy focus. Now, our grantees include hospitals, universities, community-based programs, and they're involved in lots of different kinds of activities, training, service delivery, product development, data collection, and evaluation, and also policy, public policy work and awareness-raising efforts. I borrowed this slide from my friend Marlene Wong, and she's just arrived back so she can hold me to it. But just to give you a sense of key events in our nation's history that have helped to shape the work of our network, in the 90s, there was a growing attention among policymakers to the issues of child trauma. There was a really important meeting in Cape Cod where policymakers and experts and advocates all got together to talk about these issues of child trauma and to map out a future for bringing these issues forward. That led to a government accountability study on child trauma. And it was made for Congress, and Congress actually took it very seriously, looked at the issues of child trauma, and that study is actually still cited even today. Now we fast forward to 1999, and of course the terrible tragedy at Columbine High School that we're all very aware of, and people, policymakers now had this issue of child trauma at the forefront and school safety at the forefront. Interesting to note that before Columbine, the United States Senate was already drafting legislative language to create the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. It was already being drafted. It was on the shelf. There were other priorities that were moving forward. Columbine happened, and all of a sudden, the network legislation got moving and was enacted in 2000. But unfortunately, there have been other events since Columbine that have really shaped our network. Of course, the terrorist attacks of 9/11 were key issues that our network has responded to and continues to respond to. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are among the issues that prompted a very strong military families component of our network. And for those of you that work with military families or military-connected children, I encourage you to take a look at our resources. They're really stellar. We also have a strong terrorism and disaster program, and we've got our friends from Louisiana who know a whole lot about this kind of work, but obviously Hurricanes Katrina, Rita, and most recently Sandy have been key issues for our network. And of course, Sandy Hook. And I'll talk, since this is the most recent, or one of the most recent tragedies that's garnered national attention, I want to talk a little bit about some examples of how policymakers are working to try to make sure that these kinds of events stop happening. So this is a map of our network, give you a sense of where we are. We're in 44 states around the country. We currently have 79 grantees and over 100 affiliate centers that are formally funded centers. Folks like the network so much, they stay involved even after their funding has ceased. This gives you a sense of our funding history over the last decade. You'll see that in 2001, we started with only $10 million, and at our highest have been over $45 million in funding. You'll see a little dip down in this year's funding level, 2013. Any guesses of where that dip comes from? Sequestration. Yeah, like many many programs that are really important to children and families that are federally funded, we're all feeling the sequestration cuts. Are others here in this room, are your programs cut? Are you seeing dips down because of sequestration? Yeah. And we're looking closely at the fiscal year 2014 appropriations bills, try to get a sense of where we're at. We're hopeful, we're optimistic, but still a lot of work needs to be done to get the word out about child trauma services and why they're important to keep going in these difficult fiscal times. So the network, like many SAMHSA programs, has not been reauthorized for many years. And when I speak about reauthorization of the network or other programs over the course of the next few minutes, what I'm speaking about is once Congress authorizes a program, every couple of years, it's tasked with reauthorizing it, taking a look at the program, what's working, what needs to be modified and updated. It's a nice opportunity to evaluate a program and to make the changes that may be necessary. So that hasn't been done for the network since 2006, so it's been a little while. But I'll tell you, in the days after Sandy Hook, I was still at the American Psychological Association where I was director of government relations, and we were getting calls, our phone was ringing off the hook from members of Congress and their staff who wanted to know, what can we do about this tragedy? How can we stop this kind of thing from happening? And so many legislators put out proposals to try to address this issue. One of these policymakers who's been a great supporter of the network over the years is Senator Patty Murray of Washington. Do we have any Washington natives? No? Yeah? Okay. So Senator Murray got together with her staff and talked with trauma experts from around the country and decided to draft a bill to reauthorize the network and to strengthen it. It's called the Children's Recovery from Trauma Act. And it has gained some momentum. I'll share with you in just a moment some of the national and local supporters of this legislation. Now, for those of you that have been watching the debate on gun violence and school safety, which I know many folks in this room have, in April 2013, a mental health package was put together in the Congress. Some of the key kind of things that people thought are necessary to fill the gaps in our mental health system to keep kids and families safe. And our Children's Recovery from Trauma Act, some provisions from that bill that related to the network, were included in this mental health package that was moving through, in particular, the Senate. This is a bipartisan piece of legislation. It's got both Democrats and Republicans on board. It was spearheaded by Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa and Senator Lamar Alexander from Tennessee. We had somebody from Tennessee. Fantastic. Cherokee Health. Great. So again, in these times that are particularly partisan in Washington, really nice to see people working across the aisle around issues affecting kids and mental health. So our little provision was included in this mental health package. It made it to the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, the Committee of Jurisdiction, and it was voted out favorably out of that committee. Then it made its way to the Senate floor. And as many of you may have been watching, it was attached to the gun legislation that was heavily debated in April. Our mental health amendment that included the network language was voted out favorably, a 95-2 vote. Pretty incredible. The gun bill, any guesses? Yeah. The gun bill went down and was not voted out of the Senate. So, of course, our mental health amendment that was attached to that also went down. But the good news is, I mean, the optimistic piece is, in a town where folks are not agreeing on much, we had 95 senators that agreed on this issue. We have a lot of Senate champions, and we have a number of organizations and supporters that are really rallying behind this piece of legislation. And you can imagine in the recent days with the Navy Yard shooting just last week, the terrible tragic shooting on a basketball court in Chicago just a couple of days ago, you may have seen that bipartisan members of the Senate are calling for this mental health package to be brought back to the Senate floor for a vote. So keep a lookout for this in the coming weeks. So this is the mental health package that I'm referring to. And just to give you a sense of what's in there, if you haven't already had a chance to take a look at it, it's the Mental Health Awareness and Improvement Act, again, Senators Harkin and Alexander. In addition to the provisions to reauthorize the network, there are also provisions to expand the use of PBIS and early intervening services in schools. It reauthorizes and strengthens a key youth suicide prevention program called the Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Act, which we'll talk about in a little bit. It reauthorizes grants for mental health training and awareness. It also encourages improvements to the CDC National Violent Death Reporting System. And then it called for three new Government Accountability Office reports on three topics. First, examining the mental health care for children in the U.S. Another, looking at barriers to integrating behavioral health with other physical health services. And then a status report on the Virginia Tech recommendations, right? We can't forget about past tragedies. We need to look back and see what's been done with what's gone on before. So here's the list, as I mentioned, of the folks that are supporting the network reauthorization, which is part of this package, the Children's Recovery from Trauma Act. Take a look. I know we have psychologists, social workers, marriage and family therapists, counselors. You'll see here in the room, you'll see a lot of your national organizations are on board and supporting this and are big proponents. There's even a larger list of supporters for the broader mental health package that I just discussed. So really a lot of momentum behind these pieces of legislation. So that's a little bit about where the National Child Traumatic Stress Network is in federal policy right now. We're optimistic that that policymakers will continue to value the work that we're doing and continue to see child trauma as a worthy investment by federal policymakers. So I want to switch gears to our second topic, which is to give a little bit of an overview of other things outside of the network that are moving at the federal level. And I want to mention a few recent pieces of legislation that have been enacted into law. And I also want to mention some proposals that are out there to give you a sense of what folks are thinking about for the future. Of course, the Affordable Care Act implementation, right? I'm watching my CNN this morning. There's the pros and the cons and a lot of debate, but I want to talk a little bit about that. Mental health parity implementation. There's some recent guidance that HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, put out around child trauma. ESEA, Elementary and Secondary Education Act, want to talk about that reauthorization and where it stands. And also outside of money that flows directly to schools, I want to talk about other federal proposals that are out there to integrate community and school-based mental health services and to talk about school climate. The White House has obviously been very involved, and I want to talk about some initiatives that they've been involved with. And then we have the little reality check at the end, to talk about the political challenges that we're facing in moving these forward. So first, let's talk about the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, and what's in there for children. Now, in these 2,000 pages of a bill, we're not going to have a chance to review everything. So I've just taken a couple of the highlights of what's in there. Of course, being able to keep children on parents' insurance until age 26, and that's in place. Getting rid of exclusions for pre-existing conditions for children who may have had illnesses or disabilities prior to seeking health coverage. A reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, and this reauthorization is actually until 2019, with funding in the ACA until 2015. There's also extended coverage for children aging out of foster care, allowing them to stay on Medicaid until age 26. Greater access to preventive care, making sure that there are not cost sharing or co-pays for preventive services, including things like depression screening. Expanding Medicaid coverage, and I know we have folks from around the country, and not every place is California, right? That's what everybody tells me when I move to Washington. Not every place is California, Diane. But this Medicaid coverage and expansion of the Medicaid coverage is going to depend much on what states decide to do with their Medicaid programs. And I know there's a lot of debate and a lot of discussion going on across the country. Also, establishment and expanding of the school-based health centers, and I really look forward to talking with many of you who may be interfacing or working with these centers on school campuses or in the community over the next couple of days to learn more about what you're seeing. We get asked a lot about implementation and how it's working, but there's been millions of dollars that has been funneled into the school-based health centers since the ACA passage. And finally, support for home visitation. Obviously, this program to get out in the community and meet with parents and children who may be at risk for all kinds of things, including trauma and abuse, and to get those parents off to a good start by providing home visiting services. So those are the child-specific provisions, but there's a lot happening. What are we expecting October 1st? Right. October 1st, the health insurance marketplace opens, the exchanges. So there's been a lot of discussion about how do we get the word out to the uninsured to let them know what they're eligible for and to get them connected with health insurance. And I'll just mention one resource that may be helpful to all of us as folks who are interested in mental and behavioral health. SAMHSA has an ACA training resource toolkit that may be worth taking a look at. It goes through the ACA, talks a little bit about what it does, how it works, and focuses in particular on the behavioral health conditions that folks face and how ACA may address some of those issues. It also explains a little bit about these exchanges because it's complicated. The devil's in the details, and for a lot of us, it's helpful to get some more resources. And then finally, for many of you who are interfacing with children and families who may be uninsured and want to get them in contact with the resources so that they can learn more about what they're eligible for, there's some communication ideas and materials that you can take a look at. There are lots of different websites for ACA information. I would recommend the one that I use most often and find most helpful is healthcare.gov. If you haven't had a chance to take a look, that may be a helpful resource. So let's shift gears to mental health parity, another recent piece of legislation that was signed into law requires that if a group health plan offers coverage for mental health or substance abuse, it has to be no more restrictive than the coverage that they provide for medical or surgical benefits. So again, just making sure that mental health is on par or at parity with physical health services. Now, for those of you that are seeing this in the trenches, you know that there's been a several-year delay in final implementation regulations. It's created a lot of confusion. There have been lawsuits, and there have been denial of services. So mental health parity implementation has not been fully realized yet. I will say that the one bit of good news, and just got off a call with folks at the Department of Health and Human Services earlier this week, there are final regulations that are expected next month in October. So keep your eyes peeled for the final regulations that are coming up. So I wonder how many of you saw the recent guidance put out by the Department of Health and Human Services on child trauma services. This was put out in July of this year. Okay, just a couple of folks. Yeah, I wanted to share a little information. The Administration on Children and Families, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and SAMHSA all got together and issued a recent letter to state directors of child welfare, Medicaid, and mental health authorities, encouraging them to strengthen their efforts to address complex trauma among children who are known to child welfare. So this is really, it's a long letter. It's 18 or 20 pages. I've got a copy if folks want to take a look, and I also am happy to send it out to the group. But I think it's an interesting resource that HHS took the time to say that child trauma is an issue of importance and that state agencies really have a role in getting good information out to those in the field. The letter provides not only information about federal authority and funding streams, but it also talks about strategies for coordinating services across systems, and it also provides information about good practices out in the field. So I would definitely encourage you to take a look. We've talked with some of our members who have been taking a look at this guidance out in particular states. Just spoke to our colleagues in Illinois through the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, and there is a coalition, a child trauma coalition in Illinois, that's been working very closely with their state Medicaid folks to try to help them understand what's in this letter and to try to help them make sure that trauma-informed services are infused in state systems. So this letter is definitely worth a look. Also nice that sometimes we feel a little left out in federal policy. Nice that folks took some time to talk about child trauma. So let's turn to the education setting, to in particular the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. As many of you know, this law has been around for many years. It was initially authorized in 1965. And this is the primary federal law that directs investments in elementary and secondary education. Also referred to as No Child Left Behind. There's a lot of debate depending on which side of the aisle policymakers are on as to whether they call it ESEA or NCLB, but we'll refer to it as ESEA today. Now, the primary focus of ESEA is on equity and educational access and support, and it was last reauthorized in 2002 for a period of 5 years, so it was up for reauthorization in 2007, and like a lot of laws, it hasn't been attended to in a couple of years. But there has been a lot of momentum over the years. At the end of the Bush administration, beginning of the Obama administration, a lot of policymakers across political party lines who've been interested in how do we improve the education system and how do we improve ESEA. So I just want to share a little bit about what's happening, what's been going on over the last few years around this ESEA reauthorization to give a sense of what might be coming our way. So first, many of you may have seen that the administration put out a blueprint for ESEA reform in 2010, and this was at a time where there had been a lot of momentum around ESEA reauthorization. It really looked like this was a moving train that was headed to the finale, and the administration's blueprint covered four key areas you see here, focused on improving teacher and principal effectiveness, providing information to families to help them evaluate and improve their children's schools, focused on implementing college and career-ready standards, and finally improving student learning and achievement in the lowest performing schools. So that was it's a large document. Many of you probably contributed to some of this in conversations with the administration. It's worth taking a look. And again, it seemed to be that there was a lot of momentum at the time. Well, then things started to slow down a little bit. And as happens in Washington, other priorities took center stage. But I do just want to mention that there, you know, we're talking about how do we infuse mental health into our language around schools. And sometimes education and health are on completely separate tracks and in completely different silos, not always talking to one another. But I do want to share a handful of legislative proposals that have that are out there that do infuse concepts that we care about as mental health providers. And there have been a number of policymakers across both sides of the aisle and education and mental health advocacy groups that have been supporting a reauthorization of ESEA that takes into account the kinds of stuff that we care about. And here's just a list of some of the concepts that are being debated. Student mental health, of course, is an issue, social-emotional learning, PBIS, and I know we're going to hear more from a colleague a little later today about that. Student threat assessment has obviously been a big issue. And then positive school climate, bullying prevention, intervention, those have been key issues. So it's not all been about academic performance or scores on tests. There have been folks that are thinking like we do. And I just want to share three of these proposals to give you a sense of what the language looks like. There's a bill that was introduced in the House called the Academic Social and Emotional Learning Act. And this is a bill, even the title's kind of our stuff, right? This is bipartisan legislation. We have both a Democrat and a Republican on board, which is quite rare in the House these days. Again, these folks are not playing nicely. They could probably use some of the interventions that you use in schools. So if you have some free time, you might want to come out for a visit. But this bill would amend ESEA to include teacher and principal training related to social and emotional development needs of students and allow ESEA funds to be used for that. So that's good news. It also allows funded training to include training in classroom instruction and school-wide initiatives. So they're kind of speaking our language. Another piece of legislation, this is a bill that's been introduced in both the Senate and the House with bipartisan support in the Senate. And this, the Safe Schools Improvement Act would amend ESEA to require states to direct their local education agencies to establish policies that prevent and prohibit conduct that creates a hostile and abusive educational environment. So this is really getting at the bullying and harassment issue that so many of you are encountering as talking with colleagues here at this table in the front about that and how hard that can be. It also would require the Secretary of Education to do an evaluation of the programs and the policies that are being used to combat bullying and discrimination, and to put out a report so that we would have a sense of what strategies people are using. The final piece of legislation I wanted to mention around ESEA reauthorization is called the Achievement Through Prevention Act. And I'll just mention at the outset again, this is a Senate bill with bipartisan support. This was included, provisions from this were included in that mental health package that I referenced that was debated along with the gun legislation. So this is actually on the train that may be moving in the coming weeks and months. And this legislation would allow states and local education agencies and schools to use improvement funds to implement school-wide PBIS and early intervening services. So this is, again, getting at the kinds of things that we care about. So, you know, how do you think our mental health, mental behavioral health language and concepts made it into these bills? Not all members of Congress are education policy experts, for sure, and not all of them are well-versed in mental health. Any guesses on how this made its way, this smart language made its way into legislation? It's folks like you. It's experts and folks in this room who took some time to contact policymakers, to work with advocacy organizations, to get the word out about what's actually happening on the ground floor, what's happening in schools, and what might be helpful in the reauthorization of ESEA to make our work a little easier. So that's what's on the plate with ESEA. You know, again, it's been stalled. There's been a lot going on. And we're not sure at this point whether ESEA will be brought to the floor in the remainder of this Congress. We've got another year. But I think that voices from folks like you who care about these issues are really important in this debate. Now, outside of ESEA, there's a lot of other federal money that flows down that impacts us, that relates to mental health and school climate. And I just want to give you some other examples of legislative proposals that are out there that could potentially have an impact on us if they make their way down. I know we're going to have some colleagues a little later today that will focus on LGBT youth and some of the issues that they're facing and how we work effectively with this community in schools. You know, it's always surprising to me that we don't have equal protections for LGBT youth in schools, the same protections that we do for other students. Does that shock anybody else? Yeah? Maybe I'm just easily shocked. But the Student Non-Discrimination Act is a piece of legislation that's been around now for several Congresses that would try to get at this issue, to give LGBT students an opportunity to have the same protections in schools as their peers. And in particular, this piece of legislation would prohibit discrimination and harassment that's based on actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. And it would give these aggrieved students an opportunity for some legal recourse. So again, you know, it does surprise me sometimes that this isn't already law. But this is an important issue that has support in both the House and the Senate. It tends to be a bit partisan sometimes, but I do think there are a lot of voices from the field who are working with LGBT youth who are really experiencing a lot of stressors and challenges. And I know this is an issue we're going to dig in a little later in the session today. Another piece of legislation, the Mental Health in Schools Act, is also a bill that we have a version in both the House and the Senate. And this is really focused on how we integrate school-based services with community-based services. We know that a good bulk of mental health services are being provided to school-age kids in schools, but there are also community resources that could benefit from being good partners to schools and vice versa. Again, how do we better integrate healthcare and education? And this would allow for more funding for the Safe Schools Healthy Students program, to expand access to school-based mental health services, to provide more training, and also to provide some education for students and families who may be experiencing mental health issues. Again, you see PBIS and community trainings around signs for mental health problems. Again, language that is not accidentally here. You actually see in the second bullet, trauma-informed and culturally appropriate school mental health programs. I mean, it sounds like Mecca, right? This is what we want. Well, again, not accidental that the words trauma-informed got in there. It wasn't that some congressman was thinking, you know what, it should really be trauma-informed. People got out and got involved in the drafting of this legislation and shared what they knew, and it made its way into the bill. So really important, and this is some of our friends in the trauma community that helped to inform this bill. You'll also see that this was included in the mental health package that was moving along in the gun debate, so keep posted on this. Now, I referenced the suicide prevention initiatives that were also part of this mental health package, and how many of you are familiar with the Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Act program out of SAMHSA? So this is another SAMHSA program, a sister program to our program at the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. This is a bill that has incredible bipartisan support in both the House and Senate, again, which is pretty unheard of these days. This program was established a number of years ago following the death by suicide of Senator Gordon Smith, his college-age son. And he really very bravely, he and his wife spoke very bravely about the mental health concerns that their son had faced and have been incredible advocates for suicide prevention, trying to make sure that other children and youth don't face the same kinds of stressors that their son did. So this program's been up and running at SAMHSA, and it's provided grants to folks in 49 states, 48 tribes and tribal organizations, and 138 institutions of higher ed. Now, this would reauthorize and strengthen the existing program to allow for prevention programs in schools, higher ed, juvenile justice settings, behavioral health settings, and also in foster care. And funds can be used for a number of different activities, public education and outreach, training of professionals, which is a really key area, and also early intervention and treatment for those in need. So this has been, a hot topic, also part of that mental health package that was discussed. So the final bill that I'll mention is the Mental Health First Aid Act, and not to be confused with psychological first aid, which sometimes happens. You hear first aid and you think of the same thing. This also has bipartisan support and has a bill in both the Senate and the House. And this is really getting at how do we educate the public? How do we make sure that it's not only the responsibility of mental health providers, but how do we make sure that the public is well educated on the signs and symptoms of mental health problems? And this is coming out of some of the recent tragedies. You know, people, you always hear on the news, didn't somebody know? Couldn't somebody have done something? Could somebody have intervened? And this is about getting information about warning signs, about how to de-escalate a crisis, and also resources, what kind of local resources are available, and getting those resources in the hands of those in need. Now, there are a lot of target populations for this kind of training. The bill specifies a number of key folks, including first responders, law enforcement, but you'll also see that third bullet, a lot of focus on schools, students and parents, and again, across levels of education, from elementary all the way through higher ed. There's also opportunity for training for community leaders, primary care providers, and also for veterans, among others. So again, this was also part of the mental health package that's been discussed. So that's some of what Congress has been up to and what's on the agenda that we may see come to fruition in coming weeks and months. But I'll say there's an important role, obviously, for the administration. The White House has an amazing bully pulpit. I mean, who else can get on television and be covered by all of the main networks any evening that they might like? The White House has a lot of authority to be able to do that. And I know that many in this room, including Marlene and others, have been advisors to key White House initiatives over the years. They really do want to hear from experts like us. And I'll just mention, you know, after Sandy Hook, many of you know that President Obama tasked Vice President Joe Biden with convening a group around gun violence prevention and reduction. And they reached out to lots and lots of stakeholders across the country to really try to figure out what we can do to stop these kinds of events from occurring. The White House plan came out with four key priorities, and you all are well aware of these: closing the background check loopholes, banning military-style assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And then three and four are really in our bailiwick. Making schools safer and increasing access to mental health services. So again, two of the four items in the president's prevention plan are really directly related to our area of expertise. Plus, they're far less politically controversial. You do not want to be the ones having to debate number one or number two right now in Washington. Tough times. So the president and his team and the vice president recognized that a lot of these actions to accomplish these four goals were going to take congressional action. But the president has a whole lot of authority as well. And the White House team actually identified 23 things that the president could do simply with executive action that he could do on his own. And I just mentioned one of them here, and I don't know if some of you saw this incredible press conference with the president and these kids and Joe Biden. These are four children. This was in January, shortly after Sandy Hook. These are four children who wrote to the president after the Sandy Hook tragedy, and they wrote the most precious letters. You know, one of them, I think the young woman between the two boys, the young girl between the two boys, wrote about that she knows that the president's busy, and she knows that he can't do everything without Congress, but she really wishes that he would try his best. And these kids just wrote amazing, heartfelt letters. So they were invited to the White House when the president signed 23 executive orders to try to do what he could. And I'll tell you that this is just one area that's been a big one for the mental health community over the years, and in particular our colleagues in the research and scientific areas. As many of you know, there's been a ban on federally funded research around gun violence over the last many years, and it's difficult to do that kind of research without appropriate funding. One of the executive orders that was signed in January 2013 opened back up that funding stream and actually directed the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to begin doing some of that work about the causes of prevention, causes and prevention of gun violence. There was also a component there about video game violence, which I know has been a debated topic, but one that a lot of folks in our field are certainly looking at. Now, in addition to the post-Sandy Hook attention on gun violence and school safety, there's also been some White House efforts around the broader mental health issues. You know, we still continue to face incredible stigma around mental health issues. These are not conversations that our country and many of our communities are very comfortable in having. And so the White House in June convened a conference of key experts around mental health. And this is the first conference of its kind in many, many years. You'll see that there are lots of different stakeholders here. You have on this left side, on the C-SPAN side, you have Senator Gordon Smith, who again lost his son. You have experts on military and veterans issues. You have leaders from the American Psychological Association and from Health and Human Services. But you also have celebrities. You have Glenn Close, who has a sister with a mental health condition. Of course, on this side, you have Bradley Cooper. That's who everybody wants to talk about, usually, who made a movie about mental health issues, right? But, you know, it's important. It's important to have experts. It's important to have policymakers. But it's also, there's an important voice for celebrities and for figures that our kids and our families listen to. And from this White House conference, a series of conversations were started, community conversations, and there's a toolkit for communities to begin to engage in these kinds of conversations around the country. There have been dozens of community conversations on mental health that have occurred, and there are more planned into the month of October. There was also the creation of a new government website, mentalhealth.gov. It's hard to imagine that we didn't have a website before now, but we've got one now dedicated to our issues, and it's got some helpful resources for the public and for children and families and for providers, so I'd encourage you to take a look if you haven't already. Well, there are some political challenges, and we have to be realistic, and it doesn't mean we don't keep fighting and moving forward, but just a couple of the challenges that we're facing, and I don't need to go into depth on these, you all know them, but sequestration and other budgetary restrictions are a key challenge and barrier. There's not enough money for everything that we want, so how do we help policymakers prioritize? How do we make sure that programs that support children and families, especially those at risk, how do we make sure that those don't end up on the chopping block? Partisan politics, right? There's none of that in California, right? These are tough times. I've been in Washington for nearly 12 years, and I worked in the United States Senate in 2004 and 2005, and we had a lot of bipartisan agreement and a lot of opportunities to work together back then. I don't want to be one of those people that says, back in the day, we used to do it differently, but it is a particularly partisan time. It's been difficult to get members from both sides of the aisle to work together, and so it's a challenge and something I think we have some work to do. There also are a lot of new members of Congress, folks that have retired in recent years, new folks that have come on, and that's neither good nor bad. It just means that some of our champions on mental health and on children and families have retired and moved on, or some have passed away. So we have new members to educate, folks that may not have had visits or emails or letters from us, that may not have been out to our sites to see the important work that we do, certainly don't know about CBITS. So we have a lot of education and awareness raising to do. There are also members of Congress in new roles. So some of our key committees that relate to mental health issues, healthcare, education, children and families, there are new faces in leadership. So again, good opportunities for education and awareness raising. Finally, we're headed into election time. And whenever we're headed in, whether it's a midterm election or a presidential year, there are a lot of politics involved in taking a stand, right? I know that folks have been trying to forecast whether there will be continued votes on gun violence or school safety issues. The election cycle does play a role. Do we want to, do leaders in Congress want to be asking their members to take difficult votes on these kinds of issues as they approach the election cycle? So these are just the real challenges that we're facing. Now I want to finish up just talking a few minutes about what we all can do, how we can parlay our scientific and clinical knowledge to really inform this process, because you've seen how important our voices have been in various proposals. And first, I just want to make the case to you all, if somebody has not invited you to be part of this policymaking process, I am here to be that person to provide that invitation. Please, if you haven't had a chance already, get involved. You are an incredible resource for policy change. Policymakers need to hear your voices. And you provide three key things: scientific and clinical expertise. You know, we take for granted, because we sit in a lot of rooms like this with other experts, we take for granted that policymakers know about mental health, know about education, know about schools. In fact, many of these folks have very little understanding of the issues that we care about. So you provide expertise. You also provide the local stories, the examples. I always talk about the 1-2 punch. You give them a little science, a little data, a few statistics, and then you hit them with a personal story, something about a child or a family that you've been working with, something that's worked, something that's still a struggle or a challenge. But the anecdotes, the frontline stories are really key. Finally, if you're not convinced by those two, you're a voter. And you have the ultimate power to keep these folks in their seats. And so as a constituent, you have an incredible opportunity to influence these folks. Now, there are some key components to successful change, and we're going to do an exercise in a little while to look at creating policy change. But these are some of the, this is kind of the perfect storm of things that have to come together to see the change that we want. You need to have champions. You need to have policy champions. And these policy champions are not only members of Congress, but these are administrators in our schools. These are deans of universities. These are maybe a mayor. But we need people to stand up for what we care about. We need people who have got our back. Move down to the green. Again, the science and anecdotes, the 1-2 punch that I mentioned, are really key. And you all are perfectly situated to convey that information. We also need organizational partners. And I know, speaking for the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, we have been incredibly lucky to have so many of you in our room as partners. And we don't only need to hear the DC voices. You know, there's a lot of us in DC that are sharing this information. We need to hear voices out in the community. So partners from other disciplines, from other parts of the country, are really key. So timing is a big issue. Obviously, you know, this is, I just spent some time with my niece and nephew this weekend, the elementary schoolers, and you don't come and ask for a big favor or a big treat right after you got out of timeout, right? It has to be good timing. You have to give some thought to the appropriate time to make your request and when movement might be possible. And then finally, grassroots advocacy. And this is where all of you come in, where you can really share what's going on in your local communities and be an active voice. So what are some of the first steps in getting started? You first have to know what your issue is. What is it that you want to change? You then need to determine who has the authority to grant this request, who can make this change that you're looking for, who can provide a program change or create new funding opportunities. Then finally, you have to decide the appropriate action to be taken, the appropriate approach. Is this something that you're better off doing individually? Is it something that a group, you might have some power in numbers? Is this a request that would be best to make informally or formally? And you all know your settings. You all know your schools or your community-based organizations. You know whether the policymakers who are in charge are going to respond better to you coming in by yourself, or maybe coming in with a group. Is this something that you want to just informally talk to them about on the side, or do you want to make a big kind of public display in a formal way? Now, there are lots of different ways to communicate with policymakers, and all are effective at different times, and often in combination with one another. Letters to the editor, op-eds, press releases about new and innovative things that you're doing in your worksite can all be really important. But emails, letters, and phone calls to policymakers at all levels are really key. And the gold standard, of course, is in-person visits. There's nothing like the rapport that can be built when you're sitting in front of somebody. And these in-person visits, whether it's to your mayor, to your city council, to Congress, these are really the ways to establish a relationship that's ongoing. Opportunities for hearings and briefings, again, at all levels, press events. Site visits are really important, and I want to say something about that in just a moment. Receptions and town hall meetings that policymakers have. Very few people show up for these often. And so if you're the one that takes the time to come on out, your voice can be heard. Demonstrations. We like a good demonstration in D.C., don't we, Lisa? They're often the biggest traffic problem is folks out doing some demonstrating. And then obviously social media. And there's really innovative and interesting things that are being done to get the attention of policymakers. These are folks, again, talking to policymakers, presenting at congressional briefings, at congressional hearings, testifying, participating in advocacy events, meeting with folks from the administration. And finally, getting out there and making those personal visits. And I particularly love this photo. This is an interdisciplinary group of all different experts and advocates from across the disciplines who took a day off and took a personal day to come into Washington and make those connections. Really extraordinary folks. So how can you get more involved? These are just a couple of ideas. If you're not already actively involved in policy, some things that you can think about doing, and I'd love to talk with folks about engaging you more if you're interested. But think about working with your legislative affairs office or your communications office. It's always good to start with the folks that are doing this work in your agency and to stay on the message of the agency if you can. Think about attending a Capitol Hill event or an event here in your hometown. And this is the site visit component I was talking about. It's amazing how few of our colleagues take the time to invite a policymaker to their site, to their school, to their community-based organization. Let them come out and see the work that you're doing. We think that they understand what we do. Getting them to come out and see what's going on in their district, it's a way to brag about what you're doing and to really get to develop a champion. And finally, if you really have the policy bug, think about a sabbatical year. Maybe you need a little time away to think about a legislative or an executive branch fellowship. And there are incredible fellowships, not only in Washington, but also in states and localities, a chance to see how the sausage is made and see it up close. You might run very fast, but it's a great way to see how policymaking works. Now, finally, I have a lot of colleagues who say, you know, Diane, that's just not my thing. I don't think I have the skills for policy. I like to share this photo. These are the young suffragists of DC, a group of young girls. These are now some girls who are teenagers. But these are folks that are committed to DC voting rights. And if you ever think that you're not suited for this kind of work or you just don't know how you'd get started, everybody's got a role in policy change. And these girls, this is their tea party in front of the White House. So again, we're going to take a page out of the playbook of our young suffragists, and we're going to spend a little time thinking about a policy change that we might like to make. Could we pull up the Word document? So you all have a policy change strategy chart in your packet, and here's a version up on our screen. So I would like folks to work in their groups that they're seated with or find some other partners for this activity. And this is a chart, a strategy tool that I often use and have used over the years to think about a policy change. And you can't just decide what you want to do and then charge forward. You really have to give some thought to an effective strategy, developing an effective strategy. So there's a couple of things that we'd like you to think about. And we've got maybe 20, 30 minutes, so we won't have a chance perhaps to answer all of these questions, but let's try to get the top line issues. First, as a group, identify a policy that you think needs to be changed. And this doesn't have to be a federal policy like the ones that I've talked about. This could be something right here in your local area. And for those that drove in today, you might want to do something about the traffic. That might be a good place to start, or the potholes, or the 405, just the 405. But pick something, and it could be something that you all agree on and you have consensus, or it could be something that one of you at your table is really passionate about. Just pick something as an example. Determine what the policy that you'd like to change is, What would be your long-term goal, and what would be shorter-term victories that you might be able to accomplish along the way? Again, a lot of these bills that we talked about today take years, if not decades, to come to fruition. Just look at health reform alone, right? Decades and decades to come to fruition. Then you want to, we're missing the top. I think, fantastic. Then we want to turn our attention to allies and opponents. Who's going to support our action? Who's going to back us? And who is going to oppose us? And understanding the opposition is really key as well. Are these folks going to speak out vocally against us? Is there something that we could give them to appease them so that they won't? So again, give some thought to who your partners and who your challengers might be. Then focus attention on targets. Who are the primary targets, the folks that have the authority to grant this policy change? And secondary targets, folks who may be able to influence our top targets. Then finally, what tactics are you going to use? And this may be representative of the kind of group that you have. You know, are you bold? Are you getting out there and demonstrating? You're chaining yourself to a policymaker's door? Or are you going to maybe start with emails and telephone calls, maybe a congressional briefing or a local town hall meeting? So give some thought to the tactics that may be used. I'm going to circulate through the room, but take some time and give it some thought. And I hope that this will be a useful tool as you think about changes that you might like to make in your community. But I thank you for your attention. I'd very much like to talk offline or throughout the next few days about what's going on in your communities. Would love to hear the examples of what's working and what's not so that we can take those messages back to policymakers. So thank you so much.